Hello?
Okay.
Yes?
Everybody get the prompt?
I hit it. This is John Schultz. I hit it.
Okay.
Yep.
One. I only hit one. It did not say 1 pound.
Pound.
Right.
Okay. As long as we should be okay.
I hit the one and the pound.
Oh, no.
we should be okay. A couple things. I'm shooting to go at least upwards to 90 minutes. I know everybody maybe can't stay on that long. So certainly when you need to leave, please do. We're going to cover a lot of ground today, I hope. And if you need to leave and there's some things, questions you have that you haven't asked or some areas that are on the agenda that you were a part of this history, I'd like you to weigh in before you sign off. So certainly as we're going along, let me know on that front. If you have a question or a comment, please say your name so you know who's speaking. Those that didn't get the email, this is a toll call. It's not a toll-free call. It's a toll call, so I want you to be aware of that. Thank everybody for your participation. There'll be people coming in and out. I expect more people, and names will be announced when people come in and when they leave, but the call will be going on, so you don't have to stop or worry that the call's been cut off. Today is January 5th, 2012, and, we're here to honor and talk with a legendary ultra runner, Bernard Gomersall, and along with talking to Bernard and asking questions of Bernard, to review some key moments in the history of our sport, particularly the early years of the sport. I'd like to start off with just a little email from Bruce Fordyce to Bernard. My best wishes to Bernard Gomersall. Please remind him that whereas I don't have as many London and Brighton wins as Bernard, I won in 81, 82, and 83. I do have 8 more Comrades wins than he. Please count me in, and if you ever do something similar again. He also said, I met Ted once in New York Marathon, was impressed with his dignity. Great things about assembling this call is that I've been able to reconnect with a lot of different people.
Hello.
Hello. What's your history?
Yes.
Gary?
If someone's got this on speaker, you should take it off speaker.
Yeah, I'm getting a lot of static.
Gary, we can't hear you. I don't know if you're talking.
I stopped talking. Let's see what that static was. I was on speaker. I've gone off speaker.
Now I hear you. No more static, and I can hear you.
Okay, let's we'll continue. Yeah, again, the beauty of what in assembling this call is just being able to connect with a lot of different people that I've read about over the years and certainly have followed, but have not met, and some are on the call, some were not able to be on the call. But to me, this is this is all about building our community and preserving the history of our sport. And so this is one step in doing that. There's been a lot written about the history of our sport by Dan Brannan and Andy Milroy, and a lot of that's been published in Ultra Running. So there's a lot already down. Jacqueline Hansen, who I'm hoping will be on the call.
I'm here.
Okay, hi. Is working on history of the women marathoners, and have Jacqueline talk a little later about that. And I'm on the agenda to talk about the early women pioneers in ultra running. But a couple years ago, I challenged the running community to, do all we can to preserve the history of our sport, not only road running but the track and field side also. And certainly, I'm motivated in a lot of ways, mainly also because of my father and his impact on the sport. But in his inability to throw anything out, I have a tremendous treasures of all aspects of the sport. So along with what I have and encouraging others to preserve what they have, I just want everybody to just keep doing all we can to keep our history alive and bridge the generations. You know, in Bernard, you have an individual who's you know, met Arthur Newton, met Wally Haywood, raced against Jackie Meckler, raced against my father, and so the elders of our sport, we got to get all we can and get all the stories we can now, and with the goal that this can all inspire, history can inspire future generations. So along with this call, I'm hoping that in the future that we'll do a call about the women in the sport, 1960s women in road racing. Also a call with runners of the 1950s and linking this era of runners with prior generations. And there's still a number of runners from the era that are alive and well. And then also another call that would look at the running scene in the 60s, both from the athletic side and the race officials and the governance side of the sport. So those are some upcoming kind of conference calls that I'd like to help lead. And the Roadrunners Club of America has done a lot in terms of helping with this history initiative. We have a committee in place, working through the committee. And the long-distance logs, the Browning-Ross publications, have been archived on the Roadrunners Club website. There's a full collection that Tom Osler had. And so those are just some of the things upcoming and some of the things in place. I had an opportunity to do a similar call, and a number of you were on this with Bernard a couple years ago. And so I've got most of my questions asked of Bernard. I have a few that I'll start out with, but the way I'm seeing this is that we'll open up with any questions that you have for Bernard Gomasol, and then go through different aspects of the history of the sport. You know, most of you have seen the agenda, and people that have participated in these various historic races. We'd like to just talk about them and get some back and forth feedback, but let me start off just with a couple of questions, Bernard, then we'll open it up. But, you know, whenever I talk about my father, I have to also talk about my mother, Ruth. And, Bernard, I know you've recently lost your wife, who also was named Ruth. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about just the role she played in your successes. And, in an era when running was not normal in terms of an activity, the role that she had.
Well, this is a bit emotional because it was only recently I lost her, but the role of Ruth was total. Without Ruth, there would have been no ultra long distance running for me. She was the full backing. She gave me a full support. She made a lot of sacrifices for me. Everything we did, everything I did, she had to sacrifice things. Without her, I would have been nowhere. And I'm very grateful to her. In the 50s and 60s, when you were almost on your own, there was no finance, no backing. We had, and of course, there wasn't a lot of money coming in. So everything that we sacrificed was for running. So she gave up a lot. Now, without her backing, you know, as I said before, there would have been nothing. And I think that I wasn't unique. All the wives of the 50s and 60s made the same sacrifices. Because, of course, in those days, we'll come to that later, the ladies didn't run, so they were just on the sideline. But without them, our sport would not have gone as well as it did.
Bernard, you told me a story of how your father became a big fan of my father.
Oh, yeah.
Tell that story.
Well, the first, what was his first one?
62.
62. Well, I had just recovered from illness, and I know I was, I think I was about eight that year. I'd had serious anemia, and I was just recovering, and I finished eighth. Now, your father was running for the first time. My father was in the car watching. Now, he saw your father go over the Westminster Bridge, which, of course, is the start. And you know, I'm not being personal, but your father had the worst style of runner you've seen in your life. He had a terrible style. I think you'll admit that. And, of course, my father said to his friend, he'll never make it. Look at him. He's tired already because your father had this exaggerated style. And, of course, when he got to Brighton, he was still on this same style. My father said, oh, what a runner. And he went up and congratulated him. And from then on, because my father used to always be with me at the Brighton, he always had words with Ted and always was there to greet him and have words with him. And they became very close friends. And because my father was not in the athletics. My father was into football. So he'd never seen anything like Ted running before. And he didn't understand that this was a style, and this was a wonderful style. But it shook him. But my father had a great deal of respect for your father.
We had we talked a couple of years ago, and I asked you a number of the historic runners, including Jackie Meckler.
Yeah.
You made a comparison of Jackie Meckler and my father.
I can compare your father with Jackie as the two finest, not athletes, they were great athletes, but further than that, they were the two of the best sportsmen it's ever been my privilege to meet. They were both gentlemen. They were wonderful, how can I put it, wonderful losers. They could take losing as well as winning. I must confess, I am not the best of losers. I used to get very upset. But your father and Jackie Meckler were the most wonderful losers you could wish to meet. I mean, when they took victory with modesty. And when they lost, they were the first people to come up and congratulate the winner. They were two of the finest gentlemen runners it's ever been my privilege to meet.
Those who are not familiar with Jackie Meckler, he was a five-time winner of the Comrades.
Yes. Yeah, well, when I first went to the Comrades in 65, I spent a lot of time with him. And I'd beaten him in the race. And then he offered his hospitality, and I went to stay with him for a few days after the race. And he was magnificent, the way he looked after me.
And in 65, you broke his course record, correct?
That's right, yes, by 9 seconds.
Talk about the significance of the London and Brighton race, about the history
as
a race in our sport.
Yeah, well, it started with there was a Festival of Britain, which was a big festival all over, as it sounds. Many organisations did things. And the Roadrunners decided that they were going to hold a London to Brighton. They were only going to hold it once. And they were going to hold this London to Brighton once. And they held the race, and it was so successful, somebody said, well, let's have it a regular occurrence. So it started, and it was always held at the end of September. And it was as far as ultra distance running was in those days, when you used to get about 50 or 60 runners. But this was long before the running craze came in. And it went on year in and year out, very popular. It was a tradition. It started under Big Ben at Westminster on the stroke of 7 o'clock, the first stroke of Big Ben at 7 o'clock, and it ran the 52 miles to Brighton to finish on the seafront at Brighton, and it was a fabulous race.
What I'm going to do now is open up some questions. I think the format is we'll do questions for a while specific to Bernard, then we'll move on to some history elements that we on the agenda, then come back to Bernard and just keep it pretty open. Again, if you've got to leave and you have some things you want to say, just let me know and we'll close open for questions.
This is John Chodes in New York. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Yes, sorry. Yes.
This is not so much a question. I'm the guy who wrote the book on Ted Corbett, the biography of the Corbett.
The one that you wrote in about 77?
72, and it's just been republished.
Because I got a copy in 77.
Okay.
I remember it well because I was in hospital at the time. I had a broken neck. I got smashed up in a car.
My wife
got the copy, and I was reading it while I was in hospital.
How'd you like it?
I thoroughly enjoyed it. Some of the remarks that was picked up by my wife, especially the one where she wished I'd have lost because she didn't like she got fed up swinging the trophy.
Right, right. Now it's just been republished this year and brought up to date to the end of Ted's life.
Yeah.
And there's more of a commentary by me about my involvement with Ted. But I just want to say this. In the 60s, the editor, Fred Wilt, who compiled and edited the series called How They Trained. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I don't remember it. It's a series of books from sprinters to marathoners, how they're training.
Yes.
From mostly Olympians and world record holders. And he knew about me somewhat from previous publications in the running world. He asked me to get the training of some ultramarathoners. One of them was Jackie Mekla.
Yeah.
And this is what I noticed. Now, you said he was a great winner and a great loser. But he said...
Hello? Hello?
Hi, John.
John, are you still there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Are we still there?
Apparently we've lost John.
Hello? Hello?
We appear to have lost John.
Okay. Hopefully you'll get John back. I'm not sure what's going on. Other questions?
Yes. I just wondered, during your... running well, what sort of mileage did you have? What sort of weekly did you do training?
Well, when I first started, round about the end of the 50s, beginning of the 60s, I was doing about 75 to 80 miles a week. But as I increased, shall we say, my results, I went up to about 110 miles per week. This was on a 7-day schedule.
Got it.
I'm on a conference call with somebody.
But I probably lost...
With Ted Corbett's hand.
Okay, we're still there?
Yep.
Oh,
yes.
Mileage was perhaps lower than other people, I did track sessions, training on the track, twice a week.
So...
All that work only amounted to about 6 miles. But I was doing interval quarters. Quarter of a mile. Which only adds up to about 6 miles. Not much in the annals of a long distance runner, but as far as quality went, it was essential.
Bernard, can you hear me?
Yes.
This is John Chodes again. I somehow got disconnected.
Yeah.
And I missed probably a minute or two of the whole conversation. You mind if I can finish what I was saying about Mekla?
Yes, carry on.
This is all I wanted to say, that I wrote him and asked for his training regimen. This is back in the 60s. He wrote me back a very nice letter outlining his whole training program. Now, I know he won the Comrades 5 times.
Yes.
But he also dropped out and was injured a lot and did not do as well as he could. He had a lot of injuries. And I could see, now I was not a tremendously experienced runner at that time, but I saw from his training regimen that he was doing a lot of harm to himself. He tended to work out like 10 or 15 miles a day during the week because it was a job.
Yeah.
But he overloaded one day of the week with like 60 miles. He would run like he would run the course of the comrades and jog it.
Yes.
And then he would rest a little bit. Then he would run a very fast 10 mile. And I just looked at that and I said, that's so, you know, he'd be so stiff and his legs would be cramping from all that long running. And then to try like 5 minute of miles for
yeah.
10 miles, I could see where he was getting so many injuries. I just felt he overloaded himself. This one day was just like a tremendous crash program every week. And I suspected even then that this was a factor in why he had a lot of injuries and was not always at his peak when he really could have probably won the comrades more times. And it always stuck in my mind.
Yeah, well, I can go along with that. I never actually did. The longest training run I ever did all of my career was 40 miles.
Right.
I never did more than 40. I believed in the idea of your running was a bank.
Yeah.
And you built up the miles in the bank in a week.
Right.
You didn't just put it in one day.
Right.
And so it was over. When you trained, it came a second nature.
Right.
And I felt I could, with a 40-mile run as the longest, but all the other mileage that I was doing each day, anything from 6 miles to 10 miles to 12 miles to this 40 miles, built up over the years.
Did you ever observe this training pattern that I described with when you were with him, like the 50-mile one workout, jogging, and then the very fast?
He spoke to me about it.
He what?
Told me about his training.
Yeah, and I just felt it was too much. It was just on one day to go
absolutely
so extreme, and I felt that this is where he was getting all his injuries from.
Yeah, and I never went along with that.
Yeah, yeah.
I always had and the thing is, if I did a 40 mile on the Saturday, I would go out on the Sunday, but I would do a steady 25 on the country.
Right.
Because the country is soft.
Right.
And it's not, and it gives you, and of course, when you go out on this 25 miles on the Sunday, you are almost relaxing. You're not pushing the pace. You're just enjoying the surroundings, and you're also relaxing your legs. And that was what I did. If I did a road on Saturday, I did a country on the Sunday.
Right.
Now, talk about how you were focused on London and Brighton year-round in your training.
Yes. The London to Brighton was September, and I used to start my preparation for the Brighton in November. And it was the only thing that was in mind. Every other race I ran in the year was focused on the Brighton. That's why I was probably not a very good, by my standards, a very good standard marathon runner. Because I only had one race in mind all year. But as I say, it worked for the results I got. Okay?
Gary?
Yep.
This is John Chodes again, on a totally not irrelevant, but a side issue. Can I just say something related to another topic?
Sure.
Is that a yes? Hello?
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Is that okay, please?
It's okay.
I've amassed here in my house a lot of photographs of some of which were published of the Boston and Yonkers marathons going back to 1955. And they're very interesting. And also the 1960 Olympic trials race, which Kelly won at Yonkers and ran a 2:20. And I have a lot of I've had pictures published in Long Distance Log and Field News related to the marathon. Would you be interested in seeing some of this material? Because I don't know if anything else exists. Very little full photographic coverage is made of those races at that time.
Yes, I'd like it all, and certainly we'll save a lot of it. One of the things that I'm careful of is scrapbooks and scrapbooks being thrown away, people not knowing what is important.
Yeah. I can't hear you now.
Yeah, so please, we'll get together on that.
Yes, and I think they're terrific, and there was no other coverage at that time of those races, that particularly I was in a press car, so I had a coverage of, say, the 60 Olympic trials from start to finish, and the battles that were going on, and there were no other press photographers. They were just like reporters. And pictures of your father, of Nick Costas winning the 55 race, et cetera, et cetera. And old Johnny Kelly running the fastest time of his life in 63, which is kind of astonishing. And things like that. And cover photos in Long Distance Blog and Track and Field News, which I think now have a real historical meaning.
Great. Other questions of Bernard?
No.
Yeah, I'd like to ask a question. Golub. Hello?
Hello, I'm here. Yes, I'm listening.
Yeah, how are you doing today? What are you doing today?
Today,
at this point in time, how are we physically?
Well, physically we are not very good. But improving. Both my knees are affected by arthritis.
Okay.
But the thing is, one of them has been replaced. And on the 25th of January, I'm having the other one replaced.
Okay.
Now the one that's been replaced is wonderful. And when the second is replaced, I'm hoping I'll be 100% fit again. But I'm not allowed to run anymore.
Okay.
Why not?
Well, they say that running, I've got now a titanium knee, and the pounding on the road will affect it. I can play other sports, but they say don't run or do any bodily contact sports at all because it will affect the knee. So I shan't be able to run, but I can cycle. And of course, the thing is, at the moment, I'm dancing. I go dancing 5 times a week.
Dancing
with the stars?
I'm still fit as that goes, but that's
all right.
Both knees have gone.
That's what I like to hear, though. I mean, you're still out there exercising, doing something.
Oh, yes, yes. And I play in England. I don't know who's got it over there. We play a game called Lawn Bowls. It's an outdoor sport that's played on grass, and it's played right throughout England, and it's very, very popular. And I'm out there in summer 4 and 5 times a week, so I'm still active in sport, but not in running. Okay.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if you remember me. I ran in '64. I was the guy that set the pace with another Englishman before you and Ted Corbett passed us.
Yeah.
That was my first London to Brighton.
Yes.
And I really enjoyed it.
Oh, how many times did you do it?
I did it 3 times. I 76 was my best race when we won as a team.
Oh,
so we were always
is.
Out to get the Tipton Harriers, but that year I don't think they had a full team. In fact, you were talking about your training. I don't know if anybody's interested. When I got ready, I mean, the whole team, we had 12 guys that wanted to run the race to win. I think we wound up with 9 that went there, but that was the only time I think I really trained for anything. If I trained for a marathon like that, I think I would have ran 2:20. But I planned it around vacations. I got up to about 80 miles, and I took a day off, and I ran 65 miles back-to-back. And then I had 2 weeks of vacation where I ran 30 miles a day, 15 in the morning, 15 at night, and that's how I got ready for London and Brighton in 76.
Yeah.
But I just thought I'd throw that in, but I'm glad to hear from you and that you're still out there.
Oh, yes.
I love that.
Yes, and an interesting point that... if it can be done, I'm planning to come to live in America.
Oh, okay.
You're planning what?
I'm planning to emigrate to come to live over in the USA.
Whereabouts?
Gettysburg, just outside Washington.
Okay.
My daughter, son-in-law, and grandchildren live there.
Okay.
Now that I've lost my wife, I've nobody in England at all. So I'm planning to come and live here. And one of the plans...
Well, Bernard, if you come to New York, this is John Jones again.
Yes,
if you come to New York, look me up. Look me
have
up.
There's something about your Boilermakers race.
The what?
Is it the something Boilermakers?
Utica
Boilermakers,
where the Distance Hall of Fame is, yes.
That's in New York, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Well, my daughter is going to take me up to New York on the 7th of July.
Well, give me a call or buzz me and we can enjoy ourselves.
I'm coming back, hopefully, I'm coming back for another holiday. I mean, I've been over here since the 15th of November.
Uh-huh.
And, so I was there for Thanksgiving, and I was there for Christmas and New Year. I'm going home next Monday because I've got to go for surgery on the 25th of January.
Okay, is that on
your knee? I'm going back hopefully on the 2nd of July for another holiday.
We'd love to see you.
And I'm hoping to go up to New York for the Boilermakers.
Excellent. Hope to see you then. Gary, I'm going to bail out. Is it okay?
John, one thing, John. You got a couple minutes. Let's just jump an agenda.
All right. All right.
Right, gentlemen, can I just interrupt a minute?
Yep.
I'm going to the bathroom for a minute, but I'll put my granddaughter on.
Okay. John, both John Chosen,
yep.
John Galt. I'd like to talk about the 1966... 50-mile national championship race.
Is that in Clove Lake?
Clove Lake.
A horrible experience, yeah.
This is the first national championship 50-miler. I was there as a teenager watching this. I had, just to set it up, Jim McDonough, my father, had run a 44-mile race prior to this. And I saw the last 10 miles of this race. I was in the car with Aldo Scandura. Kind of just sat on my father's tail the whole way and then out-sprinted him in the last quarter mile or so, and it finished at Yankee Stadium. But my father's plan for this race was to go through the marathon in 2:42.
Yep.
Tesson's trying to punish and destroy Jim.
It was very hot. It was
went
very
through
hot.
In 2:49. It was a warm, very hot day.
85 degrees, I think.
And felt that he had Jim on the ropes, but he could not finish him because of the weather, so he had to back off. Well, I can't remember the mile mark, but my father came to a complete stop, was disoriented, was cramped up, could barely walk, did finish. I interviewed my father about this race numerous times and enjoyed the story and, you know, what his plans were and how he thought he had Jim on the ropes. But in talking with John Gallup the other year, he told me something that my father never said, that a water stop that had been at the same spot, this is a loop course, was moved. And so, John, why don't you go from there?
Yeah, well, what happened was is Ted was approaching the water stop, and he took a glucose tablet. And then with no water, that glucose is what did him in. That was the first time I believe he ever had a walk in a race. But
what did the glucose do?
It's like salt. It absorbs all the fluid, so all your muscles get tight. Takes everything away, you know.
Okay.
That's what made him all of a sudden come to a jaw stop because that's, you know, it's like if you were taking salt and you ain't got no water in there, right? What a little bit you got's going to take away from your muscles and everything. You got nothing in there. I mean, I'm not a doctor, but I'm saying that's what I think.
But also, I was, this is John Shodes again. I was kind of acting as an informal second to Ted at that race. And I saw something. I think he totally crashed like 46 to 47 miles. But I got very frightened because I could see sweat spurting out of his armpits, like out of a fire hydrant.
Right.
It was like very frightening. It was like the last effort of his body to cool him down. It was like something you don't ever see. And then he started to like a stagger and the muscles. It turned out to be a rather serious situation physically for him. But
well,
I don't know about the glucose. I never heard of that. But I felt
when you take something like that, you don't have fluids. Your body is going to go crazy.
Well, maybe
I mean,
so.
You know,
I never heard that story either. But
yep. No. Well, I know for a fact they moved the water stop out that was out on the thing there, and then he took a glucose, figuring it was going to be there, and boom, no water, and then your body reacts.
I want to touch on this because it's one of my moments I remember, and it was pretty shocking to watch because.
Yep.
My father never stopped in a race, walked, or never dropped out of a race. He did finish, but it had
a lasting effect on him for a year or two. It did injure him. That race did injure him.
Well, it could knock your body out so bad. It's just like if you wound up getting sick during a race and you force it. It takes a year or so to recover.
Yes.
You'll definitely, when you go out and try to do things, your body's going to tell you no, and you are not going to be able to do it. Because I've had a couple of times where it took me a year before I came back to what I considered normal. There was nothing I could do about it. I kept running, but forget about time or anything. Just the fact that I could run was, that's all. Forget about how fast you're going to run, and it took me over a year.
Right.
Anybody have any questions about this 1966 50 miler? Because I was there and got two other people that were there. If anybody has any questions,
well,
comments.
There weren't many finishes, I don't think. Milrose was the only team that finished with three men. I don't think any other team finished.
No.
So I don't know if there's anybody else out there that has anything to say about that.
What was the order of finish?
That race is in my book. On Ted, that race. So there's some. We have a recorded history of that race.
What was the question?
This is Neil Wagan. What was the order of finish individually?
Jim won. Jim McDonough. My father was second. I think Vince Chiappetta was third.
Okay.
I've got clippings from it. I've got clippings of that race. Staten Island paper.
Do you have an idea how many runners finished that altogether?
I think about maybe five or six at most.
Okay.
Wow. Yeah, and I only ran the race to so that we'd have a team, and I sort of babied myself through the whole thing, so I come out of it in good shape.
And this was the first 50-mile AAU national championship race.
Mm-hmm. Gary, I'm going to have to bail out. This is John Shows. I'm going to have to bail out.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Great talking to everybody.
Right.
Good
here.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Let's open up again to Bernard. Any additional questions of Bernard?
Can I come in? Hello.
Yes.
Can I come in on one of your questions? What lessons did you learn about hydration during training and racing? That's a in the 50s. In England, they were very strict on drinking. They didn't believe. We didn't know the significance. And we didn't know how important it was to have drinks. And in actual fact, in a race, you weren't allowed to... In a marathon, you weren't allowed to take a drink before 10 miles. And I ran in a 21-mile race, one of my very first races... This was in 1957. And I was told... Now, the temperature was in the mid-70s. And I was told, don't take a drink because it will cramp your stomach and it will make you bad. So I ran 21 miles in the mid-70s temperature without any liquid whatsoever from start to finish. Now we know how bad that was. We didn't in those days.
Okay. Today.
Well, this is Gollop again. When I started running in 1960 and got involved with the Roadrunners Club, that was the same problem for about half of the 60, up to 65.
Yes.
But
yes.
We also had a couple of girls from St. Anthony's that started coming to races, and they gave out water, and some of the other women that were there gave out water. The officials were against giving water. I still think they do it with the walkers. They don't allow them to take water till after 6 miles. But
yes.
That's crazy. I mean, you found out that, everybody individual is different. Some people can run longer without water. I, myself, if I train very hard for about a month or so, I could go about an hour, really fast. Like I'm saying, but after that, forget it. But some individuals have to have it almost immediately.
I've seen that, yes.
You have to learn yourself what you're, what it takes. But it was the early program up in the Bronx. That was God's country to me for running. That's where everything started, and that's where most of the runners developed. That's where we had Olympians, Pete McArdle, Oscar Moore. People forget about that. I'm trying to write a book about the 60s. It's about my story, anyway, how I got into the running. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Well, let's stay on that, John. Paul Fetcher here. If we go back to that era, and I remember running like international championships when I ran Moscow International Marathon, there was no water, and it was high 70s, no water till 10K, and then after that, only every 5 kilometers. But when was that changed? Because I remember in 96 in Atlanta, that they were handing out water on the track for the 5 and 10,000. When did that change? Does somebody have a recollection of the changing and the realization that you really needed water and it was okay to give it?
Well,
at all point?
I can't tell you when it changed, but I retired from serious running in 1969, and the rules were still then for drinking. So it must be after the 90s, into the 70s or 80s when it changed.
Right.
But hello, are we still there?
Yep.
In my time, these rules on drinking were very strict. I've seen people in England being disqualified because they took a drink too early.
John, in your early years at Yonkers, your early Yonkers marathon, I think at best you got water every 5 miles. At best.
Yes.
That's it's pretty remarkable. And what was it, traditionally a warm day, tough course, and my guess is that the water stops may have been more spread out than that even.
But going back to my time of training, I mean, when I used to go out for, say, a four-hour run on a Saturday, I had no facilities for drinks. There was nothing there. I have nowhere to get a drink. And if I needed one, I used to go to a garage and get a drink of water at the garage. But really, I had no backup, no facilities at all for a drink. In a 4 hour run. Many a time I went the 4 hours without a drink.
It's interesting when you see some of Saturday's runners today running around with these fuel belts and carrying
I've seen them at home and I thought, what are they doing? I would call it a garage. In fact, the funniest of all is I was out training, and I remember it well, and I wanted a drink, and I actually went into a brewery, a beer brewery, to get a drink of water. I think I'm the only man ever to go into a brewery for water.
We have a program like that called the Hash, where they run it.
Yes, in a little town that I run through many times, the industry of that little, it's a little little town, is beer. There are three breweries in the middle of the town. And it's famous. Actually, I saw some beer in one of your local liquor stores yesterday that came from that same brewery not far from home. Okay.
Great. Talk about the women in the sport. I mean, it certainly, that's the biggest change over time. Yeah. And I wanted to address a little bit about the early women ultra marathoners, but also just in general. Jacqueline, I'd like you to just talk about first what you're trying to do with your upcoming book, and you had some of your experiences both as ultra, and you had a tremendous marathon career also. Jacqueline, you there? Yeah, we had Jacqueline Hansen on a little earlier. Hopefully she'll be back on. But I'd like also, Bernard, you to talk a little about that. I know there was a female runner in the Comrades in the mid-60s, but we'll try to hopefully get Jacqueline back.
Well, Mavis Hutchinson was the first lady marathon runner I had the privilege to meet. And she was in the 60s. She was the first, I think she was the second lady. I can't remember the first one. It was a long time ago before that. But she was in the 60s, and she really pioneered women's long distance running in South Africa. And she ran in the Comrades Marathon. And I know, in my scrapbook of the Comrades, I have a picture of her finishing. Now, the Comrades, my Comrades, when I say mine, I mean the 65 Comrades. It's the only day in the whole of the history of the race where it rained. And it was bitterly cold. And there's a picture of her finishing. And she looked so bad because she's soaked with rain. And she ran with her husband and her son, and I think she beat them both.
But and what was her name?
Pardon?
What was her name?
Sorry.
Mavis Hutchinson?
Mavis Hutchinson.
Mavis Wilkinson.
No, Hutchinson. 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 Hutchinson.
Thank you.
Jacqueline on? Jacqueline back on? Let's come back to the women a little later. I'd like to just go through each of the years, what I remember, and then we'll hit the 1970 Rockland 50-miler. In 67, Tom Osler won the 50-miler in Poughkeepsie, running against John Tarrant. In 68, my father beat Wayne Van Dellen. And then 1970 was, I don't know if it's still considered the greatest 50-mile in the country, but at that time it certainly was. And Bob, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Bob, introduce yourself. I've read about you for years, and I'd like you to describe this race. I was always fascinated about this race. My father labeled it the Rockland Massacre. Him and Jim McDonough went out there, and I think Jim didn't finish it. My father got beat by nearly 20 minutes, so he labeled it Rockland Massacre. But at the time, it may still be the greatest 50-miler ever in this country. But give your account of the race, Bob.
Well, first of all, the year before, I ran my first 50-miler there at Rockland and ran a 5:22, and sometime later, I was informed that the course was a half mile short. So, even though I'd broken the record then, it didn't count. So, 1970 was the next year, and that's when your dad came, and Bruce Dern, the actor, was also there, I remember, Joe Henderson, and wrote an account of the race, described Skip and I battling the whole way. And I'm at the age where, my memory is not as good as it used to be, maybe, but I remember the race of Skip taking the lead early on and being quite a bit ahead of me up for the first 30 miles, maybe half mile, three quarter of a mile ahead of me. And at 30 miles, I felt good and picked up the pace. And it was a 5 mile lap, and it was kind of like a loop, and then an out and back section, about a mile. And so at 30 miles, Skip was, you know, 2 or 3 minutes ahead of me. And the next lap around at that turnaround, suddenly I was right behind him. And I went on past him and got, you know, a fair amount ahead of him, and was feeling really pretty well at 45 miles, and realized that I was pretty close to the world record, and that if I picked it up, I might be able to get that. So I increased the pace, you know, not a whole lot, but enough so that after about 2 miles increased pace, I hit the wall, and suddenly I was going from feeling really good to feeling like, boy, was I even going to make it the rest of the way? And I was feeling, you know, tired and sorry for myself and how hard it was out there struggling along. And at the last turn to the finish was maybe quarter to a half mile. I made the turn, and there was Skip Houck 10 yards behind me. And it just gave me a jolt, and I finally picked up the pace again, and we just stayed at 10 yards the whole last quarter and a half mile. So, I mean, it was, and I remembered him being only 1.8 seconds behind me, and I think Joe's article said it was 2.8, so, I mean, I improved my time 7 minutes from the year before on the longer course. So
that was an American record?
Yeah. That was 5:15 something.
World record at the time would have been? This is 1970.
I think it was like 5:05, something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't remember now. I knew at the time, but I don't remember now.
People on the call. I mean, is the Rockland race still considered the greatest 50 mile in this country? Were the other races that eclipsed this? Oh, at the time it was.
Yeah, and that was my last, you know, really good, probably my, you know, top level performance. I ran the next year, London to Brighton, and I think I ran my best ever 30 miles, but unfortunately it was on a 30-mile race, and struggled in the finish. And then, 3 or 4 years later, I was living in Colorado and ran a 50-mile race there that I helped organize from Fort Collins to Boulder. And, I mean, I wasn't training nearly the level I had been years earlier, and I think I was probably 6.5 or 7 hours. And I continued running marathons until about 1980. And since that time, I've tried to keep running, but now I'm mostly running local 5K races, maybe 3 or 4 a year, and running 10 to 12 miles most weeks, like 3 to 4 miles at a time. And I know when I was young, I was kind of famous for not getting injuries, but as I get older, and I notice the body is a little, doesn't hold up quite as well if you overdo it. So.
And what kind of times are you hitting for those 5Ks?
My best time last year was a 23:11. Yeah, mostly I'm in the 24-minute range.
I didn't realize it. Yeah. I didn't realize you had run London to Brighton. Now, at that point, you were one of the faster marathoners in the country at that point in your life, correct?
Yeah, well, I ran 220, and Ambie Burfoot had run a 214, and And Buddy Edelin was down that range. You know, I wasn't the fastest in the country. I was a good marathoner, and I was fourth at the Olympic trials in 68.
Right.
But, you know, I wasn't really in the, you know, the top handful of marathon times.
By the way, Bob, you were cited in a recent article by Tom Dedarian. Tom wrote a beautiful article about Johnny Kelly, and he and Ambie. Nice thing. If you want, I'll be glad to send a copy to anybody that hasn't seen that. A beautiful story about Johnny Kelly that was written the day after his funeral.
Yeah, I read Ambie's obituary, but I haven't seen Tom's article. Is that available online somewhere?
It's in Marathon and Beyond this session this month, the January February one.
Okay.
If you'd like a copy of that article, just drop me an email, Paul Fetcher. The Paul Fetcher, FETSCHER@AOL.com, and I'll be glad to send you a copy of Tom's article.
Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions about the Rockland race? Any follow-up thoughts or questions? Yeah.
I guess I'm curious, Phil McCarthy. You mentioned that you were not injured when you were in your competitive running these. How do you think you managed to stay injury-free?
Well, I kind of considered it not doing too much hard speed work. I mean, I did run lots of races. I think several years I ran more than 50 races a year, or close to 50 races, and some of that was track races at college, and sometimes I'd run a track race during the week and or on a Friday, and then on Saturday or Sunday go out and run a road race or a marathon. So I felt like I was getting plenty of speed work just doing lots of races. Now at my age now, I still don't like doing speed work, track work. But when I run a race, I'm just really sore afterwards, and when I was young and running a lot, you know, it's great to be young and healthy. You know,
you kind of
think it's going to last forever, but
we know better,
right?
The joy of being young, I guess.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
Other questions? Millrose and Central Park Track Club are the two teams that did well at London and Brighton. John, you're involved with the two of those races. Is Dave Obelkovich on the call? I was expecting Dave. I know he was involved in the 79 race. And Fritz Muller on the call? Any thoughts just about the Millrose team efforts? I mean, you went over in the 60s and then again in the 70s.
Are you talking to me, Gary?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Well, we had been over there a couple of times, and we finished second. And 12 of us got together, say, about 9 months before the race and made a commitment. And 9 of us survived all our training. And we had a terrible trip over there. We had, I forget what you would call it, but it took us 17 hours to get there. And we were going to run the next morning. I don't travel well as it is, but I got ready by getting up earlier every morning to simulate the same time as it was in London. So, but still, when the race started, I was very stiff. But still, I was in very good shape, and I was happy. I actually thought I could have won that race, the kind of training I did. But Gary was our leader. He finished third. I was seventh, and Normie was ninth. And we had Burke and Erskine. I don't know if you remember them.
Yes.
Am I right? Am I wrong? You remember that?
Yeah, I think that's right. So that's right. Gary Murky and North Sanders were the three team members along with.
And also Grotzky. So we had a very good, and as it was, we won the team in the bicentennial year, was with the, what it was all about, and that was great. It was just great. I don't know if Gary, is Gary on the phone?
I don't think so.
All right. I'd like to get his blow-by-blow, but it was terrific. You know, I don't even remember they had a heat wave in England, and actually it was nothing for us because you know how New York is in the summer hot and humid, so when we got over to 80 degrees wasn't a big deal, and that was the hottest race I ever ran in England. I don't know if Gomasol ever ran over there, but I think they had a drought there. I think when we got there in September, I had just recovered to the point where I actually brought fluids with me. That's how bad I thought it was reading the papers. But, everything worked out for us. So,
hello.
Had some great pictures which I could give you from the lungs of Brighton.
Yeah, which Gummersall again? Hello.
Yes.
It's but just to let you know, I live in England.
Right,
when you say, did I run in England? I lived in England. I'm an Englishman.
Yeah, no, I didn't say that. I
thought you said, did I spent all my life in England.
Did you ever run in Brighton, London and Brighton in 85 degrees?
Fortunately, no.
Yeah, that was just that one year that you had a heat wave.
Yes, well, I'd retired by then.
Okay,
I'd retired from serious running. Because I changed my job, and I couldn't do the training. So I actually ran, and my last race was in 1988, but my serious career finished in 69. But my the one reason that I retired was I changed my job. And secondly, I kept training, I kept running. I was running marathon. But 1977, I was in a car smash and I broke my neck. And that curtailed my serious running very much.
Okay. All right.
Broken neck, replaced hips, a bad knee. Is there any other reason you're not still running marathons?
Sorry, say again.
I'm saying, with two replaced hips, a bad knee and a broken neck, are there any other reasons you're not running marathons?
No, and if I could run again, I'd be running tomorrow. I miss the running. But of course, as I've said, I've now found other sports.
Bob Warner still on the call? Bob Warner?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi, Park. I know Paul Fletcher had something he wanted to talk about regarding the first time you met my father. I the history that's been written about our sport, you were the next dominant player in the sport after my father, certainly. And so I'd like maybe Paul to start off and then hear some words from you. But it's good to talk to you.
All right.
My pleasure. I met Park about 3 minutes before Ted met Park. We were having the 50-mile championship in Central Park. And, Park, you can probably tell us what year that was you first came to New York for the 50-mile.
1972 was my first event
out
there.
In 72. Now, this was something that was not – I mean, look at Park. He's rather broad of shoulder. He certainly doesn't look like a whippet that Ted is. And as people are signing in, Park was an unknown. And Ted said to him, what do you expect to run? He goes, oh, comfortably under 6 hours. And Ted sort of scoffed at him, like, yeah, right. Who the hell are you, kid, thinking you can do that? Well, Park came out and indeed lived up to his own pre-race billing. He was modest enough about it. Park, what did you run today?
That race was very significant for me since it was my first ultra ever. And I remember Ted didn't run because he was standing there. It was a downpour. It was a cold downpour that day. And I was kind of disappointed because I wanted to, you know, run with him, and because I always looked up to him, and I heard about all the things he had done. And actually, the first time I ever met him, he passed me in the Atlantic City Marathon. He went by like a locomotive. I mean, he was always pushing. Anyway, that 72 race, I remember passing John Garlick somewhere around 30-some miles, and the emotions just overcame me, and I started crying as I was running. I had never expected to win anything like that, and the whole thing was just an experience for me.
And what was your time that day? I don't recall. I do recall the win.
I think it was 6:02, running through ankle-deep water at times and snow flurries. It wasn't exactly anybody's race, you know.
40-mile-an-hour winds in one direction, you got blown down. 40-mile-an-hour winds, you ran into the other direction.
Right.
I remember the day well, and I figured that was a good enough day for a 20-mile run for me.
Oh, yeah.
If people don't know about Park, he's an American record holder and was world record holder of 24 hours. Tremendous athlete, and it's great to have you on the call and to be connected with you again.
Thank you very much.
Any questions?
Just to refresh us, Park, could you run us by some of those better performances, when and where and what times?
Well, I think it was in Pennsauken, 1969, no, 79 it would have been. I ran a 24-hour there and did 100 miles, and I was kind of taken aback by how well I did there. That was another cold race. I half expected my drinks to be frozen when I went to take them, and I remember Nick Marshall being there and Tom Osler and quite a few decent runners, but I wasn't really aware of the competition that much. I just kept my own pace and did what I thought I could. Because of that, I think I was invited to a race out in Huntington Beach, California. And out there, I really wasn't looking for a world record. The race started and it was overcast and it was like in the 70s, which wasn't my, you know, my ideal
favorite condition.
And the race just kept going and going, and at 100 miles, all of a sudden I started feeling so good, I couldn't believe it. It was like, well, runner's high, you know? And after 100 miles, I'm thinking, wow, this is really great. But then I have the realization that I feel good, but I still have a long way to go, you know, 6 hours or so. And so I kind of held back for a while. And then I had a bathroom break around, I don't know, 119 or 120 miles or somewhere. I came out of that and almost fainted. And after that, I was a wreck. I just kept pushing to finish. And I managed to beat the old record by about a mile. I think it was Hayward's mile, I'm not sure, or Hayward's record at the time.
Record.
Yeah.
Was it Bentley?
What was your total that day?
162 miles and some odd yards.
Bill, Ron Bentley's record? Ron Bentley?
Bentley? I'm not sure now.
Okay.
I still have the article about him setting the record, not knowing that I would ever do that. And it's funny, the day after that race, I wasn't sore at all. And when I ran, I felt like I was floating. I was not sore. It was just an amazing thing to me.
Fantastic.
Do I have a question?
Yeah.
Park?
Yeah.
Follow-up questions, anyone?
One thing.
Well, in that one.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Are you still bowling, Park?
Oh, yeah. Last night, as a matter of fact.
What's your current average?
Oh, 200.
You're the man.
Yeah.
And how much running are you doing now?
I'm averaging about 2 miles a day. And that's like I'll run 5 one day and miss a couple and then, you know, that sort of thing. But it's My main problem is I have a shoulder that doesn't like me to run. I can do almost anything else, but once I get about 5 miles, my shoulder starts bothering me, and I have to throw in walking at that point. But I have no, other than that, I have nothing bothering me, like my legs or knees or anything. I'm completely 100% that way.
Great. Well, in New York in that era, in the late 70s, with the emergence of Stu Middleman and Ziggy Power and the like, we had a number of 24 hours. Did you compete in some of those, the 24-hour runs in New York in the 70s?
Actually, I didn't. I was in a couple hundred milers at Queensboro College.
Right.
Yeah. And there was the first 100 mile I ran up there. I was in. I was almost on pace to beat Ted Corbett's American record at that time, and I thought, do I really want to beat his record? You know, but it was, as it turned out, I got tired like the last 7 miles and didn't reach it.
Well, you were running in better shoes, after all. How much was Ted's record set in Hush Puppies?
Yeah, I don't know. I wouldn't say my shoes were much better, though, you know. Actually, I think almost running barefoot would have been better than shoes.
So all depends on the surface.
Yeah, true. Well, I'm getting a lot of static or something.
Like what?
That's better, yeah.
Sounds like somebody's in a noisy place.
Hello?
Bernard, with the question about shoes, describe the kind of shoes you were.
That's one of the great things that I like to talk about. The shoes that we had. In a word, in English, it's rubbish. Our shoes were terrible. There were no designer shoes in those days. And I have a pair of shoes at home that I ran my last marathons in, and they are paper thin.
Right.
And I used to train in a pair of tennis shoes during the week and race in a very light pair of shoes at the weekend. But there was no support. There was no cushioning for the heels. And I think, consequently, that's why I've got bad knees. But the
was that the old Reebok R10?
Sorry?
Was that the old Reebok R10s? I remember Ron.
Oh, no, long before Reebok. It was before Reebok started.
Really?
Yes.
Why did you have to restart? I had Reeboks back around 1970.
Well, I started in 1950.
Well, yeah.
There you go.
We were running off the road.
I started running in 1949. I started marathon running in 1957. And in those days, you took whatever shoes there were. But Reebok hadn't even started then. Adidas were just coming in at that time. But I don't think there was a lot of effort made to research into shoes until late 60s, early 70s.
If I may interject, Ray Krolowitz here, Reebok actually started in the 1890s making athletic shoes.
Yeah, but they didn't go into, I don't think they did any deep research. There was no actual marathon shoes in my day. Nobody researched about them like they've got today.
Right, right. But they were making shoes for athletes who wanted to run faster in the 1890s. They actually made shoes with spikes in them going back all that long ago.
The group.
It's for interjection there. Go back to your story, though. I just wanted to let you know that's something that I had learned a long time ago.
I know in England I couldn't get any good running shoes.
Well, okay, I started back in 59, and when we got out on the roads, we had the Converse shoes. I think they had a
a canned stuffer, a gum rubber bottom, and I think they sold for about $3. Today, that's about all they'd be worth.
Yes. Well, when I went to the Comrades, my father bought me a pair of running shoes. And at the time, they cost the equivalent of $8. And they were the best we could buy at the time.
Yeah.
Now, do the multi-day races and the... I know you did a 50-mile track race. 100-mile or 24-hour multi-day races, did that have any interest to you?
No, because they didn't exist in those days.
Yeah.
The longest race that I can remember was the 50-mile track race, which was held about every 3 years. It was organised by the Roadrunners Club, and they in October they did a different distance each year. So it was about four or five years before my distance came round. But I've no doubt, had I been running later, I know that I would have been very interested in running them.
I don't think that there's any question that we would not be running at all today were it for the advances in the shoots that we've had that permitted us to put in the miles we've amassed over the year.
Paul, you're breaking up.
Okay. Point is, I don't think we'd be running today were it not for the advances in the shoots that we've had over the years.
Oh, amen to that.
Yeah.
Yes. I wish I'd have had the shoes then that we've got now.
Oh, what a world of difference. Yep.
Yes, and I wish we'd have had the facilities then. One of the important things, I think, is the medical development that's taking place. You know, the diets.
Would you like to comment on your diet back in the day and what sort of training you did?
The diets were non-existent. You ate what you could get. I used to work in a factory, and so all I did was I had the food that I could get in the works canteen, and I think that's why in the 1961, when I was taken ill, didn't know what was happening. All I did was I was listless. I couldn't run, and it turned out it was anemia.
Really?
I was suffering from severe anemia. Now, that had to be diets. But we knew nothing about diets. In England, we knew nothing about diets in the 60s. But the local hospital put me on iron tablets. And that made the difference. But I wish we'd have had the medical facilities then that we've got now.
I remember my coach back in 1959 telling us the night before a race, have a good steak. You don't want something heavy like pasta.
Yeah. Well, of course, having said that, it's all right. But being able to afford a good steak. don't forget, as you well know, we were absolute amateurs. In all senses of the word.
Yep. I wonder if we could ask Gary to comment on that, because I remember Ted in early discussions with Ted in the early 70s where he was already into complex carbohydrates and vitamin C and the like. Gary, could you comment a little about sort of Ted's evolution in diet training?
He went through a lot of different phases with his diet. I remember him giving up salt in the mid-60s. Later in life, he became a vegetarian, but then he changed up on that. So he was always experimenting with foods and experimenting with all things that he was doing.
This is Park here, just for instance. Before I ran the 24-hour record in California, I drank orange juice the 24 hours before the race. And I drank orange juice during the race. And that was it. I didn't have any solids for 2 days.
Well, I remember you swearing that he could call his training between orange juice and beer.
Yeah.
Going back to the liquids, I'd like to make a comment on the Comrades of 1965. I ran the Comrades in 1965 on less than a pint of liquid.
Wow.
What's it?
But having said that, don't forget, it was raining.
That helped.
And that would made the difference. I didn't. You didn't need it.
Right.
And I was less... I had lots of liquids ready because I had somebody looking after me, but I didn't need it. And it was less than a pint of liquid. But, of course, the rain made the difference.
I wonder how much weight you lost during that race.
Now, my average in a race was about 10 pounds.
Yeah.
But in 1968, in the Comrades Marathon, when it was hot, very hot, I lost 17 pounds.
Oh.
How much did you lose, Bernard?
I lost 17 pounds in the Comrades Marathon of 1968. Hello?
Yeah, keep going. Hello?
Ruthie, are you talking in the background?
Okay. Finished. No.
Hello?
Hello? Are we all right?
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
I'm here.
Yes.
Sorry, I forgot about the... I forgot and I tuned in very late. Just tuned in. Who signed on? I'm Fritz Müller. Okay, good to have you. And,
great.
I forgot about the 12 o'clock start. I got to be very late.
Fritz, today doesn't count.
What?
Today doesn't count. Just back in our day, Paul Fenner, back in our day, Fritz and I used to have some pretty good races. But before the race, we always hit each other, you know what? That, you know, he counts or today doesn't count, depending on who is playing on the thing over.
I don't know. Who am I talking to?
Paul Fetcher. Hey there.
Paul?
Yes, sir.
Paul who?
Is this Fritz Mueller?
Yes.
Good. Paul Fetcher.
You're breaking up, Paul.
Paul Fletcher.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Oh, Fletcher. My God.
I'm still alive.
You never ran an ultra marathon, as far as I know.
Oh, come on, national champion. National champion. Yeah, national champion of 50 kilometers. And then I ran a couple of minutes faster chasing you in, what was that, 79?
Okay, whatever.
Where John Cederholm was first, you were second.
A few questions, but is Jacqueline back on the line? Fritz, let's talk about your London to Brighton experience. I had failed to remember the Central Park Track Club's successes in 1980.
Right, 1980. Exactly true. And Ian Thompson won, and Kirik was second. And I think, was fourth or fifth. Fifth, I guess. And Middleman was seventh, I guess. I don't know.
Top three runners were all within the top seven
places.
Yes. We had the lowest winning score ever. I don't even know. Does the race still exist?
No, it doesn't. Bernard,
the conference call right now.
Team getting anywhere near that? First three runners in the top ten?
Sorry, say again.
The Central Park Track Club in 1980 won the team championship at London to Brighton. Their first three runners were the top seven. Were within the top seven runners.
Seven or ten? I don't know. I don't have to. I have to get the exact numbers.
Yeah. Well, I'm afraid to say, from the team point of view, I was never involved because I never had a team. No. Never had a team with me. I was always an individual. So I don't know how the teams went on. But, I mean, in the top seven, three in the top seven is a remarkable performance anyway.
Sure is.
I had one earphone on. I'm allowed one earphone. He was complaining before.
I mean, I'd have loved to have been a member of a team, but I was an individual.
Mm-hmm. Sure, I mean, Kiddick was an individual too, the year before, I guess.
Yeah.
He won. Alan Kiddick, do you have Alan Kiddick on the line somewhere?
No, I am in touch with him. He couldn't come on today. Couldn't make it.
Okay. Anyway.
Rich, when did you start competing? Because you had such a prolific career post 40 years old. When did you start running?
Around 73. I ran all my good races in the early 40s, when I was in the early 40s.
220 flat in Boston as a 40-year-old.
41, yep.
41?
Yeah, 41, almost 42.
What was your proudest accomplishment, Fritz?
Well, three sub 350 Ks.
No.
For ultramarathon, you know, 350 Ks in a row,
sub 3 hours.
Wait a second. What's the 40 K? Yes, under 3 hours, yes. And 50 miler in 5:16. National championship in 5:16, something like that. No.
Why don't we have everybody on the call who's on the call still? Talk about if there was one or two individuals that influenced them most in their running, starting with Bernard.
Well, it's people that you don't know, but I had two teammates in Leeds, back in Leeds in England. One of them I used to train with, and he taught me how to run. We used to go out for hours and he'd run. But the other chap was also a teammate, but he was my coach. And he turned me from a club runner to an international runner. And those two, one was called Alan Lawton, and the other was called Arthur Cockcroft. No, unknown outside the club, but nevertheless a great influence on me personally.
Others influences?
Not as much as those two.
Other people on the call, just curious, just who if any one person, one or two people influenced your running?
This is Neil Wygant. I had Brownie Ross, who was a two-time Olympian, in the steeplechase, and Tom Osler. They were fairly important figures to me and helped get me started and continue on.
Neil, how many Bostons do you have now?
45, and I'm afraid that's it. I'm all beat up this year. But in spirit, I'll be there. But
way to go, kid.
So it'll pass to Ben Beach if he'll time me this year.
Who will?
Ben Beach.
Yeah, good. Okay, how's Jerry Eisenberg? How many did he have?
He dropped out quite a while ago. He's got a bad knee, I think it is, yeah.
Those who don't know, Neil holds the record of the most consecutive Boston Marathons at 45.
Yeah, thanks, but I'm afraid that was it. The body just isn't holding up this year. Can't get out there and do the training.
Other people on the call, who are your
influence? Dan Larson had 25 of them, 25 Bostons under 3 hours.
Yeah, I think I had 24. Yeah, Dan Larson's still running well, yeah.
God bless him. Yeah, I've missed two of the Boston. I got 38 Bostons.
Okay.
41 New York.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
All
right, I only have four Bostons, but I'm going to go ahead and throw my two running influences out, and they were Ted Corbett, and then he was mostly from the books and from reading about him. I was very happy later when I got to meet him, know him, and actually run a couple of events with him. And then I'll call him a mentor and make him embarrassed since he's on this call was Park Varner was really instrumental when I first hit the scene. He was very helpful, very instrumental, and you know,
thank
somebody
you,
that I still think highly of okay. as far as what he did, and I'm still out here trying.
Can I pipe in too?
Yes.
I have 16 New Yorks. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah?
I ran 16 New York City marathons, and I ran 7 New York City marathons in a row, sub 230, over the age of 40.
That's great. But, that's great.
Since everybody is showing off, I want to show off a little too.
Well, you should. All right.
Okay.
All right, this is Gollum.
Gollum, oh my God.
I didn't do anything like you guys did.
I don't know.
I got it. My influence was with all the old-timers, Ted Corbett, John Sterner, Joe Kleinerman, Aldo Scandura, Lou White. All of these guys, I happened to come along when it was just starting, and I got to know all of these guys, and these were the influence. O'Hara. I'm probably missing a few names, but all of these legends. Brownie Ross,
no,
ran down in Jersey.
No,
hey, John Garrett.
Yes.
How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I saw you on the bus the other night. You didn't see
Marking.
Me. Oh, my God. Well, you should have said something.
Well, you just got off. I didn't get a chance because, you know, I work with the kids still and at the school,
okay.
And then I coach at night on 81st
okay.
Street Central Park. I'll catch you again.
Yeah.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you.
Fritz, who were your influences, Fritz Muller?
My influences?
Yes.
Bill Rogers, I suppose, you know. And a good friend of mine who was running just for fun, who invited me to run around the park with him sometime in 73.
Right.
Actually, only around the ball field.
And who is that?
Oh, it's somebody who doesn't, he's not even a Roadrunners Club. He would never know him. Ron Milliken. But he's not. Anyway, my biggest influences were Frank Shorter, Bill Rogers, and, Tatopek. Tatopek. You remember Tatopek?
Emil.
Emil.
Olympics,
May I throw something else in there? The long-distance log.
Huh?
The long-distance log was a big influence in the 60s.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep.
Others on the call want to just talk about their influences, running influences?
Yeah, when you get right down to it, so part of it, and it's interesting what we're hearing here in the influences, of course, part of it is the philosophy and part of it is the training schedule in terms of who are the inspirations. So in addition to Ted, I want to throw out some people like George Sheehan and even Jim Fix. Jim was a great guy on with, and I loved his philosophy. And Park said something before about the runner's high, and Jim actually spelled that for me, that there is no such thing as a runner's high. The thing is, everybody else is a non-runner's low. You're supposed to feel good. But it was beautiful when you take a look at the early black and white runner's world, and that's where I remember a picture of Bob Dinas from 40 years ago with him and Oxnard and running out there, and you just sort of establish some touchstones of the sport, and then we fortunately got to meet these people as well as travel and find out we're all mortals.
Bob, you still on the line?
Yeah, this is Bob.
Who are your influences?
I read Fred Wilt and How They Train when I started running and several of the other books. One big influence was Rick Spavins, who was from Long Island and came to Occidental College my sophomore year. And he brought me lots of stories of the New England road racing scene and the long-distance log, Tom Osler. And he introduced me to Ambie Burfoot, and I got to know him on a couple of visits back east back before he had won Boston, and in fact, I ran that race with sixth place. So I was influenced by Rick's stories of what Ambi was doing and his slow, running mostly long, slow runs.
Ambi's the first to say at that point, racing twice a week, but running long, slow distance in between.
Yeah, well, I didn't have an exact, program of what he did, but another influence is one of my visits back there was going with Ambi and Rick up to see Johnny Kelly, and he showed me his training logs from his college days. And so, a lot of the influence of the road running, style and long distance was based on what was going on the East Coast, even though I was in L.A.
Others, anybody else want to weigh in terms of influences? Coaches? Any coaches in terms of influences also?
Well, this is Gollop again. I don't know if this makes any sense to any of you guys, but the first thing I do when I have a new runner, I tell them rest is a positive thing, not a negative thing. When in doubt or anything, if you're having trouble getting to a workout or anything, you take the day off and you'll be much stronger tomorrow. That's the way you got to think. Now, you don't think you're going to miss it. You're going to, you're going to go backwards. I don't know how you guys feel about it, but that's the first thing I tell a new runner when I get them.
A very good point, John. My high school coach, Ron Lane, really planted the seed with a lot of us. And if I look back now, we have guys. One guy was coach at Lynbrook High School. Another guy was coach at New York Institute of Technology. Another guy is coach at the high school we went to. Another one's a coach at Elmont. So that we got a bunch of guys who just caught fire with the sport. And fortunately, it's something that's served us well for the rest of our lives. We have about 9 guys who ran together on a track team in 1961 who are still actively involved in the sport every day. And that's truly been the gift for life that Ron Lane gave us.
Ed Ayers on the call at all? Ed Ayers? Okay. Anybody on the call who hasn't weighed in on anything wants to offer any thoughts?
This is Gollop again. You want to stay young? Start working with kids in the grammar school. I work with them twice a week, and they will keep you young.
Yeah, those kids are great. This is Phil McCarthy. I worked with John with the kids a little bit. But I guess just making another comment, you mentioned high school coaches, because those were, back some of my earlier influences, I guess, back in high school, and I was just a sprinter back then, but I guess my high school sprinting coach was a big influence, and also my brother Ted, I have a brother named Ted, who was a big supporter and influence of me. So then, more recently, I guess I'm probably one of the younger runners, one of the younger people on this call. But, certainly, Ted Corbett and Rich Enamorato and John, as well as, some of these guys in the New York area, Al Prouda and all these, and I look back at the results from back then, my results now are very, very humble indeed. But, I think the community that's built up since, with the larger number of runners that there are now than there probably were in the, 50s, 60s, it's a great community, and that's, one of my major influences, because when you succeed, you want to succeed for your friends, and that's a really nice feeling.
Bernard, if you could replay your running career, what, if anything, would you do different?
I would start earlier. I would have not attempted to play football or any of the other sports, which I did in my youth, because I was absolute rubbish. My great interest was I wanted to be a footballer, soccer player, but I had no ability. And if I was at it again, I would start running from the very beginning. But perhaps I shouldn't grumble because I was actually 32 before I won my first race. So perhaps all that, all the work I did in other things might have been helped. I mean, I won the Brighton, the first time I ever won a race, I won the Brighton. That was my first win.
And I was
32 years old and I won that. But I would have concentrated more on my running and less on the other sports.
Let me go around a little bit. Neil, how about you? What if anything, would you do different in your running career?
I'd probably race less. We used to race every weekend. You know, Brownie was Middle Atlantic Roadrunner's head, and we'd have races all the time, and it eventually took a toll on me. You know, just on the pavement and hard surface. So I would say just race less.
How about you, Ray?
More multi-days in my prime. Being the teacher and the times of year and getting away to them and all, I would have liked to have really, I did a couple in the mid-80s and then didn't do another one till a couple of years ago, and that was a 3-day, just got in a 6-day, but I would have loved to have really done some 6-days, some thousands, and, you know, just gone out and ground out miles and, you know, try to stay on my feet a long time. So that's about it. Everything else I'm happy with.
John Gallup.
Yeah, no, I think I've said enough already.
Fritz, how about you? What would you do different if you could replay your running career?
All right, let me check again.
Are you talking to me still?
No, Fritz.
All right, Fritz, yeah.
Go on. How about Paul? How about you? Anything different you would do?
I would have run London to Brighton. That's the one notch on the shoes I don't have. I admire the people that did it. I remember Ted's quests for the win. I did get some of the further distances. I really admire Fritz's sub-3-hour. That was a goal of mine, the sub-3-hour 50K, and I had one bad mile that kept me from it. 3:01:02, but I didn't get six. I've won 40-milers, a number of them out at Forest Park, some of Richie's races. So I've won a number of 40-milers. I've run 50 miles, but I never raced it. So that's the other thing I think I would have done a little differently.
Bob, how about you? Any things you replay your running career? What would you do different, if anything?
Who was that? Was that me?
What would you do different with your running career if you could replay it?
Probably started earlier, because out of high school I didn't run for about 9 years. So I kind of got a late start. But when it comes down to it, all I like to do is run. I wasn't so much a racer. I never tried to beat anybody, you know. If I felt good, you know, I would go. But I never pushed myself really to try to beat anybody. I like to run from one point to another, and that's really how I got into running.
This is Park speaking, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Bob still on?
Yeah. This is Bob Dennis again. I think there's too much would really change. I was just really enthusiastic about running and ran as often as I could. I liked really just like going out and running easy all week and then running a race as often as possible. I mean, it might have been smarter or to have raced a little bit less, but I was young and it was new and it's what I wanted to do, and so I don't regret doing what I wanted to do, and it would have been nice if I could have continued at a real high level for longer, but I think I recently read a book on what's his name? Is Running on Third Wind by Mike Timm about running as you age. And just lost my train of thought. But you know, I'm just I can't say there's anything that would really change.
Well, I think we've this has been good.
Can I just put in now, please?
Sure.
Hello, Gary?
Yes, go ahead.
Right. I just want to say that if ever a man deserved to win the London Brighton, it was your father. He strives so hard. And the thing is, this probably sounds very modest because I was the person that stopped him. But he was still a great runner. And one little side is, I'm hoping that I can immigrate to your country. But one thing is, I hope they don't find out that I stopped the United States from winning the Brighton. They might not let me in. But I'd like to say that, God willing, I'm coming back on the 2nd of July for another 2 months holiday.
Okay.
But in between time, I hope that we can take steps to the fact that, to start moving on, that I can come to live in your country permanently.
Great.
But it's been wonderful to speak to all your gentlemen, and it's a privilege to bring back the memories of a running career. Thank you very much to you all.
Okay.
Thank you, Gary, for getting this all together.
Okay. Yes. All right, everybody, and we have a tape of this, so people that could not join us will have a chance to hear this, and you know, we'll do it again.
Yeah. And we'll I'll be in touch, Gary.
Okay.
And, I'll let you know that I am definitely coming back in July, and perhaps
okay.
I can meet some of the other people up in New York for the Boilermakers.
Okay, great.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Thank you again,
okay,
and take care. Let's keep in touch.
God bless you all.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you.
Bye.
Yep. Thank you, Gary.
Okay. Bye, bye, everybody. Yeah.